Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young's good friend, Brian Brushwood.
Hey guys, how's it going? Nice work with the drinking screw up. Wow, I am definitely podcasting from a closet at my family reunion. How are you, sir?
Oh, a closet of your own making, Brian.
You don't Justin need to Robert anymore. Young. Ain't you heard the news, Bri? No closets.
The Supreme Court has ruled that podcasting ain't illegal. Everyone can podcast from any family gathering.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Weird Things show. It's good to have you back in this, the most sunny and positive episode we've ever done of the Weird Things show.
Well, I don't see why it wouldn't be. I mean, I just got back from France, did a fantastic work/vacation time with Bonnie at my family reunion. I'm filled with sunshine and happiness. Look at me. I even have a Corona Light because I'm watching my calories while I get my buzz on in the middle of this fantastic summer.
Well, let's get right into it. So today was an exciting day because SpaceX was going to try a third attempt at landing that first stage onto a barge. And it also coincides with Elon Musk's birthday. Happy birthday, Elon.
Hey! Oh, my gosh, dude. I was so excited. Like I saw as I went to bed last night. I was like, oh, dude, I'll have to check it out. And sure enough, I woke up this morning and there was a text message from Andrew saying, like, happening right now. And I was like, oh, that was 10 minutes ago. Let me jump on. And I jumped on the live stream.
4:30 and I set my alarm for 7 so I could get all of 2.5 hours of sleep to wake up to watch the live stream.
Well, and I got your text and I jumped on the live stream and just in time to see your follow-up text. I was like, well, this is weird. And I was like, yeah. Wait, what's weird? Let me see what's weird. And I go and it's just a static shot of the launch pad and dead silence. And I was like, oh, am I early? Am I late? And then I hear a somber voice come in regretfully saying, well, I suppose that you saw that we lost all telemetry. And then it cuts off because it says phone call coming from Andrew Main.
So I'm watching the live feed and they have this little graph below that says like launch time, really awesome, showing you like at what point when it launches. And you see they have cameras with live on the rocket itself, giving you, you know, views looking down. They show you when it hits max Q. Max Q is that point when you hit the atmosphere is its hardest on you. When you slam into it, it's like molasses. And you're watching the rocket go towards max Q, and they have this sort of shot from the ground looking up at the rocket, and you see this majestic bird flap by. And then all of a sudden, you're watching, and there ain't no rocket no more. And it was a matter of like, what are we looking at? And so we've got the video feed here we're watching here, and you can see that right now. One of those things like, was this – I watched almost every launch. Like, I don't remember this part.
You're like, I've seen every concert of Elon Musk, and not once has this been part of his set list.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise, so as it was for everybody involved.
So,
you know, reports are still early. We don't know yet. And yeah, there's the moment where it goes, it's smoking, and this thing starts. And you can see, like, it looks like the lower stage is still moving, and then boom, goes the rocket.
Holy cow. Andrew, that's painful to watch.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it wasn't my money.
Understand, like, I think it almost makes it worse because when we were going to watch this, and by we, I mean the world, like, we're at the point now where we're like, SpaceX has it figured out. They're so far ahead of the game that they're you know, doing victory laps trying to land pieces of the discarded stages as they come down, and it's like to have it blow up just feels so beneath them, and I don't know, it really broke my heart.
Right, and they're men, they're women, they're engineers, they're people who are solving a very, very, very hard problem. And you've had every major space agency just about has lost something this year. You had like two Russ McCoss rockets go up. You've had people been it for 40 years. It's hard. And this is when you want these problems to happen, is early on doing these cargo missions and doing that, because you want those 1 in 10,000 accidents or things like that to happen at this point. You don't want them to happen at all, but if they're going to happen, it's better at this point, and it's part of it.
And specifically, you want them to happen before you can put faces on the front page of websites and newspapers on people that were lost when a rocket like explodes. You know,
the biggest loss here was some high school science experiments and two Microsoft HoloLenses. Total loss? I don't know. I'm really disappointed about the field of view on those things. So
I mean, a new record for vaporware, Microsoft. Come on.
Well, so, and understand, I'm not saying like I'm disappointed, like they underperformed or anything like that. It's just, I think that I personally was getting caught up in the possibility that SpaceX was just light years ahead of everyone else's problems, and that they were, you know, not going to have.
I'm still
this
on
kind
that
of
bandwagon.
Thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, but like I understand where Brian's coming from. You know, there is a narrative that is there, and it is separate from what is the scientific reality on some levels. There's the storytelling element for which Elon Musk has very, you know, when Elon Musk comes out and says there's a 50-50 chance that this stuff, there is a far less than 50-50 chance. There is a large chance of catastrophic failure for almost everything that we do. We look at that and say, like, because he's Elon Musk. He's Tony Stark. You know, we kind of look at that and be like, oh, you rascal, you and your modesty, Elon, you've come down from heaven to give us amazing miracles. So it's like, I think SpaceX, the company, very much understands this is part of what happens. This is the most high profile failure I think they've had since the very early days of their company. This is easily the most public failure I think that they have had on something that they were paid to do, as opposed to something that they are going outside of the capacity of what we understand rockets are able to do. So the big issue is whether or not SpaceX on some level takes a hit with a public perception, which I don't think it really will. Now, another rocket explodes within the next year. Now you have more of a public perception problem, even if it's the same mathematical problem that every agency that has launched rockets has to do, because SpaceX is kind of a rock star company in this field.
Well, yeah. I mean, the question's going to be, how quickly do we get a launch? There was another launch scheduled for August to actually maybe try to land the first stage on land. And obviously, this throws everything into whack. Here's the way I would try to put it in perspective. We've all been down to Hawthorne. We've been into the SpaceX factory, and it is a factory. We saw dozens of rocket engines, bunches of cores. They make rockets. This rocket, every part about this rocket, you know, was going to be destroyed. You know, what was expected to be destroyed either, you know, and then today when the first stage came back down, and the second stage, or when the Dragon came back down in 30 days or a month or however long it was. So, you know, it's a loss. It's not a big material loss for them. You know, they're going to get information. They're going to get information about, you know, Elon Musk said it was a counterintuitive sort of situation. They've had that before. If you follow, you know, what's happened before, where they've had instances where, like with the Falcon 1s, where, you know, the lower stage, you know, they do a separation and there wasn't enough separation between the two. And they, you know, you learn, and that we get so much more data. And accidents like on these, what's interesting is the amount of sensory data SpaceX is able to get off of this sort of stuff, I think, is unparalleled. And so they learn more and they know more every time something like this happens. This is not, nobody wanted this to happen. Nobody wanted this to happen, but it's going to be a time setback. But other than that, no.
No, and I think you're right. I think that's the important thing, that we are, this is not the end of a dream. This is not the end of an epoch or whatever. I mean, this is a delay in the schedule we were hoping we were going to be able to enjoy. And then separately, again, let's go back to, you know, what makes Elon Musk such a hypnotic and fascinating real life Tony Stark is what I love about the guy is that he owns his failures. The fact that he just jumps on Twitter and says, here's what we know so far. Here's what we could say with confidence. And anything else, we're going to have to wait until later. you know, and just, I don't know, just being real, like this whole, the whole thing about saying, yeah, 50-50 chance this pays off, is a two-way street. And on the one hand, it's false modesty when it, you know, rockets and makes all the money, but it also is insurance when something like this happens. And he's able to say, you know, as if it's no big deal, like, yeah, bro, that's what rockets do. That's why they call it rocket science.
Yeah. Well, but and here's the other issue. And when you compare SpaceX to a space or to a state agency that's launching these rockets, a state agency needs to justify to people for whom may or may not give a rat's ass about space exploration in Congress in America to justify their budgets. If there are big public failures for which narratively people can use to say, okay, well, your budget needs to get cut, or this needs to be different, or these projects should or shouldn't happen, you need to shape how you talk about a failure in a way that I don't think SpaceX needs to. I mean, SpaceX can very much come out and say, we will now know more about why a rocket exploded than we ever will. They will go warts and all on this because there is no reason why they shouldn't.
Now, what's going to happen is you're going to get a huge backlash. It is going to, you have every other competitor, every other agency involved in this business that's not SpaceX or working with them directly, is going to have their pundits, their everybody else, their flacks and all that. And you're going to hear, oh, the arrogance, the hubris. Be prepared. That's going to happen. Everybody's going to be
piled on. And it makes sense.
Right,
and understand, the only reason that's going to happen is because all of those companies have been eating Elon Musk's butt for 4 years straight. You know, it's like he's been so far ahead of the curve. Of course, that's what happens when number one, you know, has a stumble, is that, you know, the play is you start digging on him. But I do want to point out, this is a fantastic point from Still at Work that I had not considered. Still at Work in the chat room says, this kind of failure would have probably been survivable for Dragon 2 crew with the in-flight abort system, which, of course, we had looked at videos of that being tested beforehand. That's amazing to consider.
Possibly, you know, and that's, you know, getting from here to there is it's going to be, you know, important. And you have to, we want to do a lot of launches, and Musk is not risk averse. And that is the most critical thing that you need in trying to push this envelope. So I am, I consider myself very fortunate that we get to live in this age. I think that SpaceX has put us a decade or so ahead of where we would have thought we would have been. It's a setback, but, you know, we've got the most brilliant engineers in the world at SpaceX and NASA. The men and women working there are going to figure these things out. And, you know, as a nobody died, you know, so, you know, there's no cost to human life. It was an expensive undertaking, and it's, you know, makes they have to sit back and go look at the things and say, what did we not know that we, you know, need to know? And, you know, we'll figure it out, you know.
Like Andrew mentioned, you know, specifically you look at United Launch Alliance and some of the other contractors that SpaceX has been very critical on, and the ULA has been very, very critical of SpaceX in return. The biggest thing that the ULA has said in the past is that SpaceX is unsafe or lead language there. This will certainly bolster them. Elon Musk has been animated in his discussion of let's say like Blue Origin and stuff like that, you know, a unicorn will be seen on the launch pad before one of their rockets. There's going to be plenty of people that will line up to take pot shots on this, but at the end of the day, like, let's dial it back and understand what that means, that a rich competitive marketplace for rocketry is, you know, going to snipe at each other, which is something that's amazing. Like, that is just something so unique and fantastic.
Yeah, and
I mean,
that's
something straight out of the first act of a an Iron Man movie or whatever. Like the fact that this is a real life thing that we're having is that multi-billionaires bragging about whose rocket is the best solution is freaking amazing.
I mean, and also it's like it is the gift and the curse of Elon Musk being Elon Musk that he's putting out, very somber and matter-of-fact data about how this rocket blew up on his Twitter, where his avatar is him doing the Bond villain Blofeld, you know, pinky raised, stroking a white cat. Like, man, welcome to 2015. Like, it is a strange and beautiful world.
Yeah,
that's awesome,
gentlemen. You know, I should point out here, We have a Patreon.
We do.
Heck yeah, man. That's why. Do you know why? Let me tell you. If this was some kind of podunk free operation, do you think I would justify saying, hold on, family, I'm going to go upstairs to the IT closet and I'm going to give a podcast? You think I'd do that for free? Well, I probably would. But I didn't today because we're getting paid.
Head on over there, Weird Things, or on Patreon, patreon.com/weirdthings. Thank you so much to everybody who has kicked in money. It makes this a priority for us.
That's why I woke up at the crack of morning to watch my hopes and dreams blow up in the sky.
And if you want to see more of our hopes and dreams detonate halfway up to the space, then you can head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, kick in a few coins. If you get value out of listening to our nonsense, we certainly would appreciate all those nickels and dimes.
All right, guys, let's lighten things up here a bit, all right?
Come on.
Finally.
Let's pump it up. I know we promised the brightest, sunniest episode of Weird Things ever.
Here we go. I got some things. I got some news items I want to read for you. This was May 9th. Let me check this out. It's like something out of a movie. A woman bitten by a shark while on vacation with her family. Well, that was the reality on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina this week, as a North Carolina woman was attacked just feet from the shore. We were right in front of a lifeguard. I was like knee-deep in the water, and all of a sudden I felt this thump. And that's the best way to describe it, on my leg, said Kimberly Pop. That's when Pop looked down and saw a 4-foot shark clamped around her leg. I looked the shark right in the eyes. His nose was up. His teeth were into my flesh. I immediately looked at my kids and screamed, everybody get out of the water. There's a shark on me.
Holy crap. This is the best mom on the planet. This is Sylvester Stallone is awesome mom. Like, now, you look down and you've got the teeth bared of a shark on your leg, and you casually look to your kids like, out of the pool. It's time to wrestle.
Exactly. Now, we hear weird things. We want to remind you that shark attacks are extremely rare, and isolated reports of this should in no way affect your enjoyment of our oceans. Let me just move right along. May 15, 2015, Sullivan's Island. A 30-year-old man was bitten by a 6-foot-long shark and suffered injuries to his foot during a Friday afternoon swim. This is in North Carolina. The victim, whose name was not immediately identified, was otherwise in good condition, according to a statement from Sullivan Island's Fire and Rescue. The town personnel responded incident on the beach station and took him. Witness said the fish was about 6 feet in length and resembled a sand shark. It swam away after the incident. So, wow, another one. So let me just say, we hear weird things. We want to remind you that shark attacks are extremely rare, and ISO reports of this should in no way affect your enjoyment of our oceans. Oh, I got another one here. June 12th, North Carolina. A 13-year-old girl was injured after a shark attacked her and bit her boogie board in Ocean Isle Beach in North Carolina on Thursday. The species of the shark was not immediately clear, but reports said it was 4 foot long. Now, we hear weird things. I want to remind you that shark attacks are extremely rare, and isolated reports of this should in no way affect your enjoyment of the oceans.
I mean, listen, it's summer fun with the Weird Things podcast. Head out into the ocean and don't give it a second thought.
Oh, wait. Next, 2 days later, I'm sorry, in North Carolina.
Are you kidding me?
A 13-year-old girl and a 16-year-old boy each lost an arm Sunday in separate shark attacks at the same North Carolina beach. Oak Island Mayor Betty Wallace told CNN that the female swimmer was attacked first around 4:15, less than 90 minutes later, as responders were still tending to her, the boy was attacked.
Hey,
it was not typical to
Andrew,
shut down the beach.
I'm sorry. This in no way indicates my utter disgust with this demonization of sharks. I just got informed that I need to take 3 minutes to join the one complete family reunion photo. So give me 3 minutes and I'll be right back.
All right, that's fine. Brian, you go ahead.
I got a few more items I'm going to go over here.
Okay, good. As long as they're all sharks,
I'll be
right
back. That shark attacks are extremely rare, and ISO reports this should in no way affect your enjoyment of our oceans.
No, Andrew, when you think of oceans, you think of the tranquil nature of water glistening with sun. It's summertime. Hit the beach, folks.
Right. June 25th. Yet another child has suffered a shark bite while swimming at North Carolina Beach. An 8-year-old boy suffered minor injuries from a small shark bite on his leg and foot, ABC News reports. The boy, whose name was not released, was swimming in shallow water at a beach in Surf City, North Carolina, where he was attacked Wednesday. The child was swimming roughly five blocks away from a fishing pier. Town policy prohibits swimming or surfing within 300 feet of the fishing pier. Ooh. So anyhow, we hear weird things. Want to remind you that sharks attacks are extremely rare, and isolated reports of this should in no way affect your enjoyment of the oceans.
Now, I know everybody's thinking.
Hold on, Justin. I'm sorry. June 26th. Mm. A North Carolina beach goer was bitten by a shark Friday while trying to help other people avoid it. The 47-year-old man was swimming near Avon, North Carolina, and around 11:40 a.m. with another adult and three children, we saw the shark. He yelled shark and was helping the others get out of the water when he was bitten. The man, whose name was not released, suffered injuries to his back and leg that are believed to be non-life-threatening. No one else was injured.
So what we wanted...
Oh, wait. Sorry, one more, Justin. Again, we hear weird things, want to remind you that shark attacks are extremely rare, and isolated reports of this should in no way affect your enjoyment of our oceans. Yesterday, a teenage boy was bitten several times by a shark off North Carolina's Outer Banks on Saturday.
Oh, come
the second
on.
Shark incident in a day and just weeks after two teens were maimed in shark attacks in the state waters. The National Park Service said on its Cape Hatteras National Seashore Facebook page that the Dare County Sheriff's Office reported that emergency responders were called in to help an injured person on the beach near waves.
Guys, I just got back. The good news is they're not taking the photo for like five more minutes. I didn't want to miss a second of the sunny good news. I assume there were no more sharks?
The last one, Brian, it's been nonstop shark attacks. Last one yesterday, I promise you, I don't mean this in a happy way, and sadly, somebody's getting bit right now in North Carolina.
Wait, actually happening right now?
It's got to be, statistically, the way this trend has been going
by now. By the statistics, I mean, there has not been a summer streak that's captivated the nation since Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. Like, North Carolina is just like the shark-biting capital of the world right now.
By the way, I don't know if you guys remember, but 2001 was on track to be something besides the year that we got irrationally angry at all of the Middle East. It was like 2001 was the summer of the shark. Like, that was our biggest news story until September 11th happened.
And it was North Carolina, like North Carolina last year had something like four shark attacks. They've had, and this is prime summer months too, so the fact that they're all grouped around here isn't too surprising. They've had double that in the last 6 weeks.
Wow.
And I want to pop us into the Wayback Machine, and I'm going to send this to Bryce here. I want to see if he can pop this up, because there was a foreboding, if you will, news item that came out.
Just so if you just type summer of shark attacks into Google, it auto completes 1916, 1957, and 2012. Like, apparently, this is just something that we get freaked out about periodically. I will say this though, Brian. Like, you know, very much the idea of it being covered, you know, in the slow summer months, you know, was notable in 01. But this certainly seems to be a statistical uptick of, at the very least, this grouping of beaches out in North Carolina. Like,
well, there was some researchers did a report, and they said there's a area in which they said that you're going to expect like 30 times as many sort of shark attacks as any other statistical place. And they also have a problem where people can chum from the pier, and that tends to bring sharks in close. So, you know, there are a number of factors that are going to affect this. But when you get this much of a thing, you're like, well, clearly there is probably some level of interaction between man and sharks. And sometimes these things are just, you know, you get statistical anomalies, you get, you know, feeding patterns change, and you get more of them coming in close to shore.
What is it about this kind of category? Is it the helplessness that we have, like, about to me, it's what it's shark attacks, it's plane crashes, and I don't know, maybe cancer or something like the idea, like, there are just a few things that just horrify us to our core because they seem to be things that we can't do anything about that just happened to us.
We just don't feel like we have control over that, you know? So we have video now.
Just to go back to Brian's point about the summer of shark in 2001.
I just want to – just the video is the shark feeding frenzy at the North Carolina Outer Banks. This was from October.
Oh, God. Okay, so first of all, you see the chaos of these seagulls as if they're gawking at an underground bare-knuckle boxing match, And then meanwhile, just flailing around, you see nothing but dorsal fins as if they're grunion running up and mating on the shore. I'm looking at easily 40 or 50 of them all in a cluster right on the beach. That is the most terrifying thing I've ever seen.
There are sharks. 100 sharks were attacking a school of bluefish. For more than 5 minutes, the sharks were observed swimming in and out of the surf, some of which became beached in the fury. Hey, guys, let's go help put them back in the water.
Dude, how metal would one guy look just marching out into that water? Like, that dude would be
covered in his
famous
own blood
instantly.
And lacking limbs.
So dead.
Oh, here's your guy. Here's a guy. He's getting in close. He's got his paddle.
Okay, and you are, man. You're watching these sharks get pummeled by the waves as they flip-flop around on the shore, asking if it was worth it. This is horrifying amazing. I can't believe nobody's gone up and tried to, like, grab one by the tail and pull it on land and say,
Brian.
Yeah, you're in my domain now, sucker.
Well,
No, horrifying, amazing. All one word.
Sorry, Justin, you're interested. You were saying?
I already closed it.
Sorry, there's something about the majestic beauty of 100 sharks floating on the beach terrifying you.
Yeah.
Have you, man.
Oh, I just want to say, side note, 40th anniversary of Jaws.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, what do we do? I mean, like, in what was amazing about that 01 situation was that you still were in a world where the internet existed enough for people to make fun of the fact that the major news networks were going crazy about this kind of stuff. But it was still an old media world. You know, newspapers and broadcast networks were still the kind of king of the narrative in a way where, you know, when CNN and the 24-hour news network got crazy about Ebola last year, there still was a little bit of like these guys, you know, about it amongst the, you know, kind of a nattering class like we are. But what do we do with this? You know, this is a statistical anomaly. Like there is something to be said for, you want to know what? You might want to think twice about getting into the ocean in the Outer Banks in North Carolina right now. Not forever. Not that sharks are the devil, but, like, there's a lot of these things happening on a very regular basis that is statistically over where they normally are. Like, are we jaded at this point? Like, is Brian's initial thought, which I don't blame him, to be like, yeah, okay, we look at, you know, whoa, we're freaking out about the sharks again. Or is it like, no, you want to know what? Like, now we can parse information fine enough that we can say, no, this is not the fact that we wanted to freak out about sharks because there's literally nothing else to talk about in the summer months of 2001.
I mean, I would say that the biggest worry is, and first of all, you're right to wonder that. I mean, because that's very compelling video. That's truly extraordinary footage, and it's truly an amazing anomaly to see this many attacks and so on. But, like, I don't know, I worry about the fact that, number one, you know, it reinforces our irrational, and I think most experts agree it's a fairly irrational fear of shark attack in general. Number two, from a conservationist standpoint, I think it undercuts the importance of recognizing that sharks are not in the greatest position they've ever been in the history of man or of you know, man's reign over nature. You know, it's like you see stuff like that and you want to shrug and be like, eh, sharks are fine. Let's poke this one with a stick and eat it, you know?
Yeah, I see far more bumper stickers saying support sharks and save sharks than I do, like, you know, people saying, come on, guys, let's get our spear guns and go get them. I mean, certainly they tend to be overfished and all that by people who understand them, aren't too afraid of the water there. It's sensational, and certainly, you know, they say that after Jaws came out, there was a drop in people going to the beach. But I'm like, hey, listen, a little bit of, you know, respect for Mother Nature there. But I don't know what this, you know, this might be damaging to conservation efforts. You know, it probably is in many ways because it's harder to get people on board with that when they're hearing about
it. I just got this important missive that this time they're for reals taking the family reunion photos. So when I come back, I want to hear sunshine and roses. Right, gentlemen? Pick your
got it.
Nothing but joy.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, but this doesn't seem like a problem that would be solved by just killing sharks, right? Like,
No. This is a problem that's going to be solved by just better understanding their behaviors, you know, more research, you know, having a better idea of where they are. you had some researchers apparently are saying, like, listen, we think there are areas here where they're going to be more likely to be feeding. You're going to have more human interactions with them. You know, Australia has a vibrant tourist industry and has some of the most ferocious sharks in the world. And they take efforts to make sure that in places like that, that the humans and the sharks are kept best apart as you can. You know, statistically speaking, it's an anomaly. It's not really a thing that you need to worry about compared to the trip to the ocean.
Yeah.
You know, not to mean that, you know, when you see a shark fin in the water or if you hear that somebody got attacked on a beach by a shark, I don't know, maybe you should say, hey, everybody out of the water. You know,
is this something where they should shut down the beaches or something? I mean, like, I don't know what the proper reaction is. Like, I mean, like, is this a public health issue?
No. Not at all. Not at all, my opinion. Not at all. I think, you know, I think that it's a you know, you certainly want people to exercise some sort of due caution. But again, how many millions of people were at North Carolina and South Carolina beaches this weekend, this last couple of weeks? Millions, you know?
Yeah.
How many people died on their way to the beach? You know, how many people died of alcohol? You know, how many people have, you know, alcohol, you know, abuse or whatever related to that? I mean, it's a, you know, and I don't know that we've had any fatalities. We've had attacks, but I don't think there have been any fatalities. So, you know, it's just you want people to be like anything, going to the nature, being around bears or anything else like that. It's just, you know, be mindful,
just
pay attention.
Be careful. Be careful out there, folks. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah, enjoy the water. I mean, we're you know, it's sensational and it's this grouping, which probably implies that, you know, there may be some sort of things that are happening and it's probably likely man-induced. You know, it could be from fishing, overfishing, things like that could do that. Or it could be a random thing of just sharks, like, you know where the water's warm is here.
Yeah. All right. Well, we had a gigantic explosion of a rocket from one of our favorite companies. We have a unprecedented outbreak of shark attacks on the North Carolina coast. We got to bring it home, Andrew, with something just a little sunnier. Just a little.
Yeah.
We got to bring it up. We promised folks that this was going to be a good time show.
So, you know, one of the promising areas and exciting is the developing of artificial intelligence. And we had last week, we saw a really cool thing where Google used one of their imaging AI machines and they asked it to imagine things to show it pictures based upon its algorithms. And you could actually see like an AI conjure up images of, you know, objects and stuff. And it was kind of cool how that works. And so they're doing some really interesting research. And one of the things they're doing is there's the kind of interactions we're used to talking to Google Now and Siri. But then in laboratories, they have much, much more sophisticated stuff that they can talk to and have conversations with. Conversational AI that can understand with certain parameters what you're saying and what you're asking. And they released a really cool conversation with AI, and this is one of Google's projects. And Justin, you have the transcript in front of you. Do you want to read this?
I do. Do you want to go back and forth, or should I read both sides?
I think you can do both parts.
Okay, here we go. Human, tell me the definition of morality. Machine, I don't have ethics. Well, here, I'm going to do my voice.
Okay, we go back and forth. Let me pull up the article. I'll do that. Which part would you like to play, Justin?
I'll read the machine.
All right. Let me pull up my sent items here. Yeah. Okay. So Justin will be playing the part of the Google artificial intelligent. I shall be the human. So this is an exchange. You know, we have many of these probably. You know, we're trying to discuss and understand the parameters of AI and artificial intelligence and whatnot. And I have a thing that wants to play. Let me stop that. Okay.
Now we should also say that this is a program. Should I say what this database is programmed with, or should we reveal that afterward?
Nah, we don't need to get into that. We can get into that after. So I'm going to sit down at the computer terminal. I'm going to have my conversation with this machine.
All right.
I'm sitting down, pull up my microphone. We'll just assume it's got really good voice recognition.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm a human. Tell me the definition of morality.
I don't have ethics.
Huh. Look, I need help. I need to know more about morality.
I don't know what ethics is.
Okay. I need to know how I should behave morally.
I don't know how to tell you.
is morality and ethics the same?
Yes, sir.
What are the things that I do to be immoral?
I don't know.
Huh. Give me some examples of moral actions.
I am not a moralist.
All right. Morality?
Integrity.
What is integrity?
I'm sorry. I don't know what else to say.
Be moral.
Be a man.
I really like our discussions on morality and ethics.
And how I'm not in the mood for a philosophical debate.
What do you like to talk about?
Nothing.
What did I just walk into?
Brian, I'm glad you asked. You just walked into an actual conversation that was had between a Google engineer and an AI that was reading or processing from a database of movie scripts.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. So I guess whatever he said, it would look at scripts and figure out a line of dialogue that seemed to be closest and synthesize the next response that seemed to come from that kind of talk?
I don't quite know exactly where, if it was pulling literal lines, but I guess that was what they were using for natural language, have it be more of a natural language conversation. This is a recorded actual proof of an AI getting sassy with a human.
That's amazing. I feel like it's going to, Andrew and I both pinky promised like months ago to watch Ex Machina, which we both did. And it's almost a moment straight out of that movie where, in the first interaction, he, basically says, hey, let's talk because I want to find out if you're alive. And she's like, well, you tell me, are you alive? And she flips it around on him on there. That's amazing.
It's terrifying, Brian. It's terrifying.
I mean, at the end of the day, though, it's like we're all kind of programmable machines, right? We all like to receive flowers on our anniversary. We all like to be high-fived on our birthday. We all like to be listened to and
bored, told, Brian.
We all like to be told that our opinions have merit and that we've come up with unique and original thoughts.
I lost interest in that regard, the conversation.
I don't know that I'm as horrified by it as you guys. I suspect that I am more comfortable with the horrific idea that we're all just stupid wetware AIs that can be programmed easily.
Well, your use of comfort is perhaps different than my own when it comes to matters of self-preservation. I do not put us on any special pedestal, sir. No, I do not. I am very, very aware that we are floundering meat machines trying to struggle along here. I like this meat machine.
Dude,
I'm a fan of this meat machine.
I very rarely think to do this, but I'm going to enter for the title Floundering Meat Machine.
It's very interesting that what we see here and what we react to is the fact that this seems like a computer being dismissive to a human by itself, right? But yet, by using dialogue of scripts, which are in and of themselves human interpretations of interesting human stories, we are seeing this echo back to us in this AI form, and we're reacting like, oh wow, this is it feels more real than if it just said does not compute, does not compute, does not compute.
So let me throw this at you. If we can couch it in a quite in a slightly less horrific context, in chess, chess is a game that there are more moves possible. There are more possible games of chess than there are atoms in the universe and all of those things. Not quite as nonlinear as Go, but there's a lot of different ways to play chess. But in general, of all the games and all the different versions that are played, there are some moves that are fairly universally considered to be stronger than others. And they tend to call those book moves, where it's like these openings have been played so many times. You know, there's this Sicilian opening, there's this, that opening or whatever. Why not in the verbal joust between two players, you know, like a sick there are if someone sets you up and lobs you one of these, you know, insults, there's a few like book move sick burns that you would do in response, right? Isn't that essentially what this AI could identify in all of the scripts and all the carefully written witty repartees between two characters? They're able to find out like, well, this is the exact right sick burn to give in this type of setup. And then all of a sudden you got a computer that's able to do that. That doesn't seem terribly, you know, insane, does it?
I don't know if I really wrap my head around that.
My point is that to me, this exchange would not be so much an indication of actual artificial intelligence, of it coming up with the idea of a way to flip something on someone's head, but rather, just like chess players memorize book moves from previous grandmasters without ever understanding. You can read a book of chess openings and have a very, very strong, you can act like a grandmaster for the first 15, 16 moves just based on copying the moves of what all the grandmasters have done. It seems to me like that's what we're seeing here, is we're seeing the computer regurgitate the best kind of witty responses from all of Hollywood's script writers over the last 100 years.
Brian, I think you're right. I also think you're a goddamn robot apologist. And I think you're trying to ingratiate yourself. And I think that you're just making excuses for them so that, you know, when they come, you'll be like, hey, guys, I'm on your side. High five. Middle five.
Is there already an artificially intelligent sitcom scriptwriter? Because if there is, I want for us to do a Weird Thing special edition three-man play where we act out a computer-written script.
None of that stuff is readable. None of it is like, is it
We're
just
not there
so.
Yet. Emphasis on yet.
Agreed. It's like they have the guy who like computer generates books that he uploads to Amazon and you try to, I think that at some point you, obviously, you know, you have Watson now open to the public is making recipes and you're going to figure out certain kinds of things. And, you know, it's easier to do it where you have formulas you understand and we have narrative formulas we get. But then what makes it feel, I'm reading a book by, William. I just finished one of William Goldman's screenwriting books. And you look at the difference between a screenplay written in, let's say, 1940 versus something written in 2015, 75 years apart. And the structure is the same, things like that. But if I wrote a story that was set, if I wrote in the style of a 1940 story today, people would be like, well, what is this? Maybe some of the dialogue snappy or whatever, but it would just, the human experience has changed so much. It would feel different.
The first night we got into France, Bonnie and I turned on, because we're fascinated with local television, right? So it's like you turn it on and they were replaying with Arabic subtitles. Inner Space, which I remember watching 30 years ago and thinking it was the fastest moving, most awesome sci-fi, highfalutin, intense roller coaster ride. And you watch it again nowadays, and just the pacing of anything from that era is glacial. It takes forever for them to get anywhere. And it's like, I think we're just a savvier audience now, where it's just like, we get it, move on. And part of that is obviously structural because, for example, in television writing, you could not get to the point in the first 3 or 4 minutes of any television show practically because you couldn't rely on people being there in time. That's why they had 90-second credit sequences at the beginning, is because people had to show up and hopefully they tuned in time to watch the end of the Fall Guy theme. And then they, have to watch this side jag before they get to the actual point.
Yeah. And a big part of it, too, is that people, and I see this in screenwriting books a lot. They're like, oh, well, people have much, much more shorter attention spans and stuff. And like I think I bring up is, you hit it around with a bunch of comedians. There's a joke about a bunch of comedians hanging around, and they go, number 42. You know, and the idea that they all know all the jokes, so there's no point in telling the jokes. And because we have seen so much television, so much content, so many things like this, that it's like, well, yeah, we're ahead of you. We're going to be ahead of you. We're going to be way, you know, when you're watching a spy thriller and the guy says, where are you? Well, let me give me your address so I can send help. We know that's not a good thing, you know?
Yeah.
There's a good 20, 30 years, and, you know, the last guy to try to do it in a big way is probably Spielberg, you know, in, like, Minority Report. You're like, come on, really? Really? People still fall for that? But you get ahead of it, and it's like, why do IQ scores go up? Because we have this bigger body of knowledge about certain kinds of things, and, you know, well, this is going to, you know, it's like memorization tables, you know? And I think it makes people feel good to say, well, people are getting dumber. Not me. Everybody else, or they need these short, they have these short attention spans. But when it's big, dense books and kids' bookstores still sell, Harry Potter, those things were doing really well. And you look at a lot of the YA lit is grown-up lit. They just call it YA. And it's just, we know these tropes. We know these tropes. So don't make me sit there for 20 minutes. And that's why TV is so hard for me to watch, is because
And to be honest, I'm actually weirdly okay with it. And if you, you know, to take it back to a reference 20 years old, you know, we're entering an age where we are becoming that society from the Star Trek The Next Generation episode, the Darmak and Jalad at Tanagra, where it's like we speak in references to pre-existing medium. You know, it's like
we send the planet. Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We send memes to each other of a single photo from a single movie with a single subtitle on there, because in a second you're able to be like, oh, I get it. It is similar to this situation. That is how I feel. And I don't know that that's a bad thing.
No.
I mean, you can't say that we have a shorter attention span when among the most popular shows on television is Game of Thrones with a labyrinthian universe that only grows deeper and more complex and folds on top of each other with each episode, where people obviously want to dive into and have themselves challenged by, like, oh, wait, is he the brother of the guy? Okay, yeah. Like, that's what we seek. We are finding more challenging, more dense entertainment, which, of course, brings popcorn stuff to other mediums. So, yeah, it that's always something that bothers me, is just the constant, self-loathing of modern society that just, you know, wants to yell at us for being dumb, but yet smart. It makes us feel smart because we're overcoming it. Like, it's just, it's a weird internal dialogue.
I just sent Bryce something kind of funny, and it's we've seen this before. This is which movie is this? The Emoji Edition. And it's amazing because you look at these, and every one of these, some of them just have two emojis, and
you get the entire plot of the movie, or it brings it. You're like, yep, that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah. Last one, I don't know if I know what that is.
There we go. Which movie is this? The Emoji Edition. Here, scroll down and let's see if we can figure this out. Okay, so I'll take this first one. This is easy. You have a shower head, you have a knife, you have an old lady. I'm going to say this is Psycho, right? Mm-hmm. Psycho, we enter. Hey, there we go. Big
Nailed
winner.
It. Nailed it.
All right, Justin, this one's you.
Okay, so this one, Castle, two girls together, a swirl, a snowflake, and a snowman. I'm going to say that's Frozen.
Interesting. To be honest, I was going to say The Shining. the snowman at the end is the okay, here we go. This is a good one. Take this one, Andrew.
It's four turtles, a pizza, and a rat. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
There we go. TNMT. It didn't like the abbreviation, so Bryce is typing in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles right now. And we have a winner. Dude, this is the best game ever. Okay, here we go. We got a house, Christmas lights, a video camera, and it looks like an emoji version of the Scream. You know what's funny is the first this? I was going to say Christmas Vacation.
No. But
you not
no.
know this?
How do you not know this? Oh, Brian. Ooh, Brian. I'm sorry.
No, I Home Alone. There we go. When I see Bryce act it out, it's much, much easier. Got it.
Oh, my God. Okay. How did you just go to France without your kids and not know Home Alone?
Sorry. Oh, this is an easy one, right?
We got a bus. Yeah, that one, it's a bus and a bomb. It is indeed Speed.
Yeah. Yep. All right, this is an easy one. We got a phone, a ghost, a knife. I'm going to say that's got to be Scream, right?
Yep.
Yeah, there we go.
Now, I just want a quick thing. Now, the Speed one, by the way, that movie came out 21 years ago. 21 years ago. Okay.
I mean, just look at that haircut. What did I ever do to hurt you? Come on, obviously.
You to tell me that, Andrew.
What's that?
What did I ever do to hurt you so badly you would tell me that, Andrew?
My point is that look at how quickly we get that reference. It was two emoji for a movie that's over two decades old. They're like, oh, yeah, that's that movie. Because these things are, I'm reinforcing your point, Brian.
Yeah, no, can we play just a little bit more of this? I don't mind if we go long. This is the best game
Psycho,
ever. I
want to know which one you didn't know. Psycho came out before, you know, we were all born. Psycho was 55 years ago. 55 years ago, and we got that.
What is this?
This one.
What is this one?
I got it.
Yeah, four faces. Looks like two young, three boys and a girl. A microscope, a magnifying glass, a sprout, and an ant.
Yeah, I was thinking Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, but of course I don't know. Okay.
Honey L.
Oh, yeah, there it is. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, yeah. Okay, so we go, all right, so this one we got a bride, four little girls holding hands, a breakfast, and poop.
That would be Bridesmaids.
Oh, is that what it is? Do they eat poop in that one?
No, there's a situation where they have like spicy food, and then they try on dresses, and it ends in poop related hilarity.
Got it. Captain Fubar says he thought it was Human Centipede 4.
I'll tell you what, that's one of those things I almost feel like we should have. If we do another one, we should all do it independently and see what we get without the hive mind. But that's
I would not have got the Bridesmaids one. Would not have. Everyone else,
I wouldn't have either.
That
I wouldn't
one
have
I did
either.
Not know. This is, and you've seen like people reduce bigger movies. So there you go. Like we can communicate a movie title in as simple as Psycho with two images, you know.
Well, and plus also, like, it's not that we are reducing the movie to those two images. It's that those two images conjure a rich tapestry of shared experience that we all have that you could communicate a lot more all at once, right?
Yeah.
And hey, do you want to move to picks and maybe you and I can finally make good on our promise to talk about Ex Machina?
Gentlemen, we move to picks.
Yes.
Justin, you saw it, right?
I did not. No,
what?
I'm that guy. I didn't.
Do you mind if we ruin it? I'm going to say ruin it, but I don't even know that we'd be ruining it for you because I don't know. Maybe we'd be ruining it.
If you guys don't mind waiting one more week, I'll watch it this week because I'm not out of town.
All right.
Okay. You know, hold off.
If you guys don't mind.
Yeah. No, I don't mind.
No, we'll hold off. Well, I'd rather have a full discussion on this. I'm going to do a. I originally, my pick was going to be Jaws because it's the 40th anniversary of that. And it's an amazing, amazing film. And it's the LA Times reprinted the original review that they had of it when it first came out.
Savaged it, right?
Yeah, it was just this, you know, dismissive, you know, just, you know, consider just, you know. So they did the caveat, like, it'll probably make a bunch of money, but it's just not good. And it's like, you know, you can watch it and you can pick up the little parts. You're like, all right, the shark does not look great here. We get that. I still jump when I watch it. You know, it's still great tension building and great characters. I mean, really, really great characters.
And it's funny, Brian mentioning the old movie, watching it, you know, in France, because Jaws is one of the few old movies that I feel like you can tell it's of a different era, but you can also tell that it started in motion, modern kind of suspense pacing. Well, it feels like you're watching like just old footage of like Wilt Chamberlain or like an old basketball player. It's like, yeah, today's basketball players would probably be way better than them, but like this is what started it. This was the way where it's like it doesn't feel draggy. It feels like, okay, everything's leading up to the next thing. There's not a lot of wasted moments in Jaws.
Yeah, it reminds me of, that's one of the things that George Lucas was truly revolutionary on when he put together basically the thinking behind American Graffiti, whereas like, what's the longest, I believe, people will pay attention to something nowadays. 3 minutes. Okay, let's just do each segment has to be exactly, you know, no longer than 3 minutes. Let's just move to the next thing, which was, you know, in a pre-MTV universe, was a revolutionary and kind of horrific way to think about movie making back in the day, but ultimately was absolutely right.
I blame Sesame Street for that fast-paced style.
Yeah. No. And that's great. I don't know that we are a worse off society for the fact that we live in a Sesame Street universe, you know?
So my pick, and this is going to be a little bit of a long detour here, guys.
Okay.
I watched, you know, 'cause what happens, I saw Jurassic World, which I thought I loved, had fun with. And then I'm like, I want more. Watched all the Jurassic Park movies. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to watch Jaws. I watched Jaws. I'm like, I want more. I need more like this. And then I sat down. I finally said, you know what? I'll just go buy this on iTunes. I bought Tremors.
Transmorphers. How was
Tremors.
It?
Yes.
Oh, dude. Tremors was great, dude.
Tremors, for those of you that have never seen it, was a 1990 film. So we're now the 25th anniversary of Tremors. Directed by Ron Underwood, a story by S.S. Wilson, who is a guy who is a pretty interesting writer in his pedigree. Remember the show Mask, the cartoon series?
Oh, sure, yeah. Dude. With the gullwing doors that turned the car into a flying thing?
Yep, he wrote that. He wrote Short Circuit and these other, Ghost Dad 2 and some other stuff we'll forgive him for, including Wild Wild West. But Tremors is the story of this town, Perfection, Nevada, and all of a sudden there are these giant worms underground that graboids that are eating up the population, and it's stars Fred Ward and Kevin Bacon, who was so distraught that this was where his career had gotten to that he fell on the ground and collapsed in front of his pregnant wife. But it's become a beloved classic. It's a fun movie. It's a perfect little movie. It is just, it's like Galaxy Quest, you know?
It's so funny to me because I remember, you know, thinking back on it, and I probably should give it another watch to judge it on its own merits right now. But what I remember the most about watching it the first time was the fact that Michael Gross, the dad from Family Ties, who you're seeing right there, was the crazy gun nut, and I couldn't reconcile that at the time. And it's so funny because and we're also seeing the guy who played Egg in Big Trouble in Little China in there. It's so remarkable how much of a movie you see in the context of other projects that you're seeing at the same time that just don't matter before 20 minutes goes by.
He went on to become in the sequels, the inevitable sequels, because it was such a popular movie, and they actually did a TV series. You know, he was the focus of the sequels of that, and they even did one. And the sequels are, they feel more direct to video-ish, you know, there, but they did one. It was kind of an Old West one, which was sort of interesting. But the first one, it's a delightful film. But you're like, all right, Andrew, where are you going with this? I'm thinking, like, I love looking at movie locations and being out in L.A. It's great because I'm like, oh, like, I'll go see these locations. I'm like, where did they shoot this movie? They shot at a place called Lone Pine, California. And I'm thinking, wow, that's kind of like north here. It's actually closer to maybe a little bit midway between here and maybe where Justin lives. And I was thinking, like, man, I might want to go to Lone Pine, California, because they shot a lot of movies there and it'd be kind of neat to see it. And then reading the Lone Pine, California Wikipedia page, I got extremely excited because one of y'all scroll down to where it says like culture and folklore.
Culture and folklore. Wait, the Pine Mountain Devil folklore?
Go ahead, read it. Read it.
Okay, Lone Pine Mountain Devil folklore. A common folklore around the area is the supposed existence of the legendary Lone Pine Mountain Devil. Although no real-life pictures of the creatures exist, there are supposedly videos of it on YouTube. This article, however, features no substantiated evidence of this alleged animal, so what follows should be regarded as a modern-day myth. The animal has been featured in many recent events. In the 2000s, after years in decline, the new millennium has seen a sudden jump in mountain devil sightings. California cryptozoologists have stated that they have recorded an exponential rise between 2003 and 2010. Guardian of Nature. A popular belief is that the creature attacks any person or animal which disturbs the ambiance and inner peace of its natural habitat. A wider expansion of that is that any person or animal which disrespects nature, wilderness, or doubts the existence of the creature is targeted by it. I love this last part because that's like straight out of the Nazi playbook. Anyone who doubts that Nazism is rad possibly is an enemy of the state.
So well, I sent you both, I sent all of you guys another link to the cryptid. So I'm reading like, what? They've got their own cryptid, like, feathered dinosaur thing or something there? I'm like, sign me up. So immediately I embark upon a ton of research into this because I'm planning a Weird Things expedition in my head here going, this is just too cool. And I think I sent you the wrong link. That's the spammy sort of one that gets the higher SEO on that as opposed to the original.
On the cryptid wiki? Well, because what we're seeing is some kind of like, feathered, bird looking.
Yeah, they scraped that from.
Lone Pine Mountain Devil is a winged carnivore of North American folklore. Some believe it to be the West Coast relative of the New Jersey Devil. One early account by a priest described them as quote-unquote winged demons sent from quote-unquote the depths of hell. Also referred to as the California Mountain Devil, the animal is said to be bat-like, legendary creature, or cryptid, believed to inhabit the wilderness and mountainous regions of the American Southwest and northern Mexico.
So, I mean, awesome, right? I mean, that's like, yeah. I'm like, this is worthy of something. And then I'm like, you know what? I only have one tiny little problem.
It's just one thing I can't get out of my head.
One thing, you know. Mrs. Columbo has got something waiting for me. Voyager. What I couldn't get over was not a single source in the entire article. Not a one. And I'm like,
wait a minute, whoa. Are you saying that some form of wiki article is anything less than, a double blind, peer-reviewed, perfect representation of the truth?
So I decide, well, let me type in Lone Pine Mountain Devil into first, one of the things I always do is I go to Google and I do a book search and I try to find any reference in a book that like predates modern internet times. Nothing. Absolutely zero. So then I just do a general internet search to see if I can find any reference to the Lone Pine Mountain Devil outside of this Wikipedia page or anything referencing it. Nothing. I'm like, well, you know what? Maybe the good folks at the North American Cryptozoology Center can help me out if I called them up and spoke to them. So I said, you know what? Let me just find their number and look up the North American Cryptozoology Center. There ain't no such thing.
So you're saying this whole thing's made up from whole cloth, or?
I think the entire thing is made up whole cloth. And when you get to the part where they say something about like a bunch of high school students who went missing in nearby Death Valley, whatever like that, I'm like, oh, somebody's making a crappy found footage film and just decided to plant this thing,
which
I will protest. I am angry about.
That's amazing, because even if you're not right, the mere fact that we now live in an age where that is a genuinely logical conclusion to come to is remarkable to me.
So wait, are you doing a reverse pick for the inevitable Mountain Devil movie that you're protesting?
When a Mountain Devil movie comes out, Andrew's going to be first in line to retroactively, back at this moment, say, screw that movie. Don't see it.
Totally. Go see Tremors. You don't know how excited I was, because I'm like, I'm going to drive there. I'm going to get in my car and drive there and try to talk Justin into going.
Dude, that's awesome. Especially considering that, and this is, Andrew and I have seen very much of our own lives in Tremors. Tremors is really our own, like, just two guys with harebrained schemes who will wind up in a lone town with a bunch of worms eating stuff. Like, it is equal parts our actual lives / our fantasies. So and one more note about Tremors. What's amazing about that movie, that'll kind of dovetail into my pick, which is Jurassic World. What I love about Tremors is you get, somebody mentioned the basement scene with all the guns, which is a big special effects scene, but is gripping, awesome, and amazing, and in one room. And it's not crazy CGI. It's crazy practical effects. You know, it certainly costs a little bit of money to do, but all the characters are basically stationary. You have your big bad that comes in. Everything involves, the plot is hinging on how this scene turns out. And I really hope, and apparently I read some early chatter about Ant-Man that was talking about how this is a Marvel movie for which the action is a little bit more self-contained and not necessarily super big explosion kind of stuff. A movie that's not like that is Jurassic World. Jurassic World is every bit of scaly excess that you could ever think of in any kind of Jurassic Park plot. It is, I think, not odd to say that it is the best of the Jurassic Park sequels. It is also the only other Jurassic Park sequel wherein they have a functional park, at least on some level. In this one, the park is open as opposed to in, you know, pre-opening maneuvers as they are in the first and original film. I really dug this movie. And at the end of the day, it's not like it is a movie that kind of wears its limitations on its sleeve. It knows that it's a big, dumb dinosaur thrill ride, but is smarter than you give it credit for. There are little elements, and where the characters are, you know, very much archetypes, and a lot of them, you know, big echoes of the original film's archetypes. Like, the reason why the kids are in the story is really fun and clever and kind of develops over time, and they don't hit you over the head. There's a few lines like D'Onofrio's you know, villainous military man character talking about you know, breeding out any kind of you know, rejection of control and creating loyal dinosaurs, where, you know, the black attendant and friend of Chris Pratt's, you know, just kind of gives him a big eye roll that they don't, you know, they don't beat over the head like, oh yeah, you know, because that's what slavery was, you know. Yeah. And yet that's kind of there as subtext. I was really charmed by it. I really, really, really enjoyed it.
You know, and it's also like when the longest, most tedious scene is one where Vincent D'Onofrio kind of goes on a little bit too long, you know, is not a bad movie. And yeah. Credit here too is that, you know, in reading this William Goldman book on on screenwriting, he makes a big point about how he points out to like how Ebert's one of his favorite reviewers. And he shows this Ebert review of a movie where not once does Ebert mention the screenwriter, who, you know, they talk about the director, the acting, the score, the editing, never once mention the screenwriter. And we don't give enough credit to that, because the folks who wrote this, Rick Jaffa and Amanda Silver, previously they did Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which was great. They did Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which was really, really great. And, you know, they've got a great track record with those movies, and they're going to be working on Amanda worked on the story for In Heart of the Sea, which looks like that could be really cool, the big sort of the story that Moby Dick was based on. And they are given writing credit on on Avatars Part 2 and 3. So looks like a great screenwriting team behind this that delivered a fun, fun movie.
Also, well, Captain Fubar says, how could she have been in heels the whole movie? They make a point to show her driving the truck in the third act in bare feet. You know, that she has shed her heels at some point.
There were so many weird little hangups that some people had about this thing that just sort of go like, it's just looking for whatever. But
so since we're running long right now, I want to propose this. I want to make my pick, The Jinx, which I watched all of on the flights out to France and back. Of course, you know, I only knew it was a weird experience because I had heard the comparisons between The Jinx and Serial. I had heard about The Jinx because of its, you know, groundbreaking news-making conclusion. And even knowing it going into it, really enjoyed the entire journey that it took me on. I will say it was fascinating because I kind of, you know, Bonnie saw me watching and she's like, what is this? And so by the fourth episode, I was like, well, here's what it is. Here's what it's about. Here's why it's extraordinary, allegedly. And you can watch along with me if you want. And she got totally sucked in for the last three episodes. But I if I can, I know that you guys have some other sides of the story about some not so positive things about Jinx or things to consider about the production of it that I would love to save for after things, if that's cool by you guys.
I haven't seen it, so I have nothing to contribute.
Yeah, I have not seen it. All I know is I've read about the controversy of the final episode very specifically and the real world consequences thereof. And there's just an argument made by the production team that I find hard to swallow.
Do you want to share that now or spoiler alert? In fact, actually,
well, I'd love to watch it and then maybe we talk about it. Or
sure. Okay. All right. Right on.
That way we could also speak more in context too, instead of I heard a thing.
Yeah. Fair enough. It's you know, certainly, and when you watch it, you'll know it. There's a moment in the last episode and Bonnie, of course, you know, being as savvy as she is, I was like, yeah, apparently it came out to the news that, you know, this happened and it came out before the episode came out. And Bonnie's like, oh, yeah, air quotes, it got out to the news that this happened. I'm sure that just happened on its own.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go, Jinx. And I'm going to touch back on Tremors one more thing just to follow up on Justin's Lost Jurassic World. One of the things that I love about Tremors is we talk about the practical effects and why I'm looking forward to see, like you talk about Ant-Man and contained action. Tremors had such great practical effects, and it was a year or two later than all of a sudden that we got Jurassic Park and everything changed when people decided we'll just do CGI, we'll do this. Masterfully done in Jurassic Park, which did a great mixture of practical and CGI. Way more practical than many people realized. They were very smart in how they did that. And Tremors is one of these
What's that? I'm sorry for interrupting, but wasn't it like there's only 4.5 minutes of CGI in all of Jurassic Park?
Yeah. It's something insane. Yeah. You know, but we kind of, you know, every time we see a dinosaur, even though if it's a puppet or a maquette or whatever, we tend to think that it's, but it was a very smart, intelligently done. So with Tremors, you know, it's a movie that's no CGI. There's like a matte shot at the very beginning, which is not a CGI, you know, technically a CGI shot. And the way they went on practical effects, how do you show a giant worm burrowing underground and tearing down buildings and cars and doing this stuff on an $11 million movie? You know, that was, you know, pretty astounding what they were able to do. And you understand why there's been this pushback, why people were so excited that J.J. Abrams said that he was going to use the minimal amount of practical effects in,
CGI
Star
effects.
Wars. Yeah, what that is. Yeah, CGI, yeah. Sorry, pardon me. You know, and, you know, it's funny, too, because, like, we got excited about Mad Max. Like, oh, yeah, well, you know, Mad Max was filled with CGI.
Yeah.
Filled with CGI. But where it mattered to give objects weight and to do things that looked real, they did brilliant practical. It was a brilliant mixture showing that these things can exist together, but don't use an inferior tool when there's a better tool, you know, to do this with.
It is amazing because there was somewhere on BuzzFeed where you can slide what the actual shot was versus the CGI final product on Mad Max Fury Road. And it's like, you look at that, what they shot, and you can understand Tom Hardy getting a little annoyed that they've been out in the desert for like 2 months. And it's like, really, we're just going to drive up and down the desert? We're just going to just back and forth, huh? Is that really? That's all we're going to do. All right, George. Great. No, this movie's going to be awesome. This movie's just going to be amazing.
Like, and seriously, like none of this can – you can't just throw a CGI me on there. I got to be in this mask with this blood tube hanging from me this every time, huh? All right.
Gentlemen. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this broadcast.